This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace. You know when you're really stressed or not feeling so great about your life or about yourself? Talking to someone who understands can really help. But who is that person? How do you find them? Where do you even start? Talkspace. Talkspace makes it easy to get the support you need. With Talkspace, you can go online, answer a few questions about your preferences, and be matched with a therapist. And because you'll meet your therapist online, you don't have to take time off work or arrange childcare. You'll meet on your schedule, wherever you feel most at ease. If you're depressed, stressed, struggling with a relationship, or if you want some counseling for you and your partner, or just need a little extra one-on-one support, Talkspace is here for you. Plus, Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance? No problem. Now, get $80 off of your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Rise of Justice Movement. My name is Zachary Mallory, and I am the founder and the host of the Rise of Justice Movement podcast and the Rise of Justice Movement. Today, I'll give a viewer discretion as advice due to the nature of the topics that we will be discussing. Today, I am joined by Kelsey, all the way from snowy Michigan. Kelsey, welcome to the Rise of Justice Movement podcast.
Thank you. I am so happy to be here and I'm so grateful for the opportunity to talk to you today.
Yeah, absolutely. So what's the weather like right now? I mean, I know that there's been like a lot of like snow and like very heavy snow. Luckily here in Kansas and Missouri, we miss that. It's just bitterly cold. But what's the weather like going on for you right now?
We actually just got our first snowfall of the year yesterday. So we've got about maybe inch or inch and a half of snow, but at least it's sunny, but very cold. So yeah. Starting to feel like winter.
Yeah, absolutely. 1.5 inches. That's still, you know, all it takes is literally a dusting for people to lose all sense of direction whenever they are driving. I have come to realize that. And I think growing up in the Midwest, it helped me realize that we have some of the worst traffic patterns. And they can't even drive whenever the pavement is completely dry. So, feel free to introduce yourself to our audience and, you know, kind of walk us through a bit of your journey. And this is the point in the podcast, you know, obviously, you know, everybody knows me. They don't want to hear my voice because you are the guest of this episode. They want to hear about you and the work that you do, your experiences, your background. And from there, the floor is yours.
Great. As Zachary said, I am born and bred in Michigan. I grew up here in a very small town, about an hour away from where I live today. I went to school on the East Coast and kind of lived in multiple different states before making my way back to Michigan about 10 years ago. So my story and kind of journey really comes from a place of survivorship. So I am a domestic violence survivor, also a cancer survivor. And I think the journey that I've been on in the last 10 years or so has really been about sort of acknowledgement, grief, acceptance, and then finding my sort of power and own truth with the story, with the experiences that I've had. So I was in a abusive relationship for nearly 10 years, from the time I was 18 through 26. It was physically abusive and emotionally abusive. And I was able to leave unscathed and kind of rebuild my life. But it took until probably 2015 or 2016 for me to really be able to even name the fact that I was abused. And I think that's a pretty common journey for survivors of domestic violence and sexual assault. It can be, there's a lot of shame, there's a lot of complicated feelings. It's not black and white. And I was really in a place where once I left, I just wanted to like make up for lost time and move on with my life. And that can only take you so far. And I personally hit a wall when during the Kavanaugh hearings in 2016, I believe, or 2017. I made the mistake of listening to the testimony of his victims, and it just broke something open inside of me. I started having panic attacks and was really struggling. And it was at that point that I went into therapy. From that point on until today, I've really kind of come to terms with both what happened to me and kind of the role that I played in it, as well as really learning how to like heal from it on my own terms. So for me, being brought up in the Midwest, there's sort of a layer of expectation of like politeness. You just kind of don't talk about things. You don't want to offend people. You don't want to worry anybody. And I think a lot of kind of the suppressed emotions that I had around my experience were tied to some of that. And I both through learning to kind of accept the being a victim and a survivor of domestic violence, as well as going through cancer treatment, and also some of the stigma that comes with talking about being a cancer survivor, ha really led me to the path that I'm on today. And one of the things that I realized early on, after I was kind of able to articulate, yes, I am a survivor of this. Yes, I got through this. Yes, this is part of me, and talk about it with other people, I realized that there are a lot of other folks out there who share the same experience that I had, and or connected to it, or were empowered by it in a way that I didn't realize kind of would happen. So when Trump was reelected, I was probably like lots of people. I really was stuck for a couple months and was angry and sad and scared and just didn't know what to do and felt really frozen. And I just decided that I needed again to be out there and start talking and sharing my story. And part of it was I just had to believe that I wasn't the only one who felt frustrated, who felt scared and wanted to do something about it. Similarly, kind of, talking about being a survivor, and finding that connection with other people through that story, I kind of reversed that in my activism. So where I live is a very small town. It's very white. It's very suburban. It's relatively wealthy. So it's kind of an insulated little bubble. But a lot of the work that I've been doing is sharing my story, putting a voice to what activism can look like in a small town community. Which I believe is incredibly important for us to have sustainable change. And also, probably the only way we really make it on the other side of authoritarianism and create a better democracy than what we had before.
Yeah, absolutely. And I admire the work that you're doing because I think it's so crucial to get our communities involved in understanding what's happening with healthcare, understand what's happening with survivors, understand what is happening with, oh gosh, there's so many things going on right now that it's really hard to kind of pinpoint and want to focus on. But at the same time, it's very intersectional. And I know you bring an intersectional approach too with multiple identities of being both a DV survivor but also cancer survivor. And you're the definition of a thriver, the definition of a survivor, the definition of an advocate for change. And I see that ambition in you. So first of all, it is an honor to sit down, talk with you on this podcast, but also to amplify your voice in the work that you're doing and how our communities can recognize that, hey, maybe something isn't right. Maybe something isn't going the way that we want it to. And everything that's happening right now is by design. And it's the lack of leadership on both sides of the aisle. And I've come to realize that. And I think last night, on November 9th, 2025, I think that kind of showed us when eight Democratic senators decided to sell out their constituents and say, hey, maybe your health care doesn't matter. And they caved. Now, why is that important to recognize? Because our politicians are not going to save us. What is going to save us and what's going to fight back is our organizing efforts, because we won't go back. And that's the reality that I am trying to see. But whenever we have the leadership of Chuck Schumer, who has been complicit, and I'm not trying to get too political here, but it is very relevant because Jeffrey Epstein files still are not released. Why is that pertinent? Because this. And again, it's all connected. It's all in connectivity. And I want to make sure that we will not go back. So, with that being said, let's walk through more of your journey. Walk us through, what are you seeing in your community? What are you hearing? What are people talking about? Are you involved in any other local organizations? Just kind of walk us through like what you're doing, with a little bit of your story. And just kind of like amplifying that and turning, obviously your rage into action and mobilizing people.
So I've always been relatively active, and definitely very informed and very much a politophile. My mother was a criminal defense lawyer. My parents are diehard liberals. So I was raised in an environment to kind of make sure that you're always that you have empathy for other people. Raised to believe that the government existed to help, not impede, and that you should always be questioning like authority and motive. And I, but I, but at the same time, I haven't had sort of a sustained activist role until recently. So we've always donated and, here and there I would get involved in things, but it was kind of in more specific or isolated areas. Like I did some activism with Planned Parenthood when I was in college in New York City and with Native American communities at a later point in my 20s. But it wasn't until this year that I really like gave, I don't want to like almost like gave myself permission to be a voice for social justice and for community building where I live. And I think for women in particular, it's really challenging for us to feel like we should be the person kind of using our voice in this way. There's sort of a default pattern to like, well, someone else more qualified, or someone else who's done this before, or someone else who's got a better story or a different story. It makes more sense for them to be the one who do this, not me. Like it's not mine, right? And I kind of came to this realization that like that's not right. And the only way that real sustained impact can happen is if regular people like me decide to go out there and make change, especially in small towns. And I really agree with you that, I am completely just appalled by the capital D Democratic Party right now, and firmly believe that we need some real change in leadership, in order for us to have the kind of big tent progressive vision that we need, and that the best thing that I can do and that the majority of us can do is focus on our local communities where we are and get people involved. So, in February of this year, I just decided that I had to start somewhere and had to do something. So I spun up a very quick little website, printed off flyers with a QR code to it, and just went downtown in the little town that I live in. It's about 5,000-ish people in town, and then about 15,000 people kind of in the surrounding townships, and just started handing out flyers and putting them up in coffee shops and at the grocery store, that were just like, Chelsea, take action. The town I live in is Chelsea, Michigan, and my name is Kelsey. It gets a little confusing. And I just, by serendipity, handed this flyer to a woman, and she introduced herself and said, there's this meeting happening at the library. It's going to be a bunch of different nonprofits and progressive organizations that are going to present. You should come. So I went home, grabbed my husband, we went to the library, and there were like probably half a dozen or so organizations, ranging from One World, One Family, which does a bunch of different sort of immigration activist and nonprofit work, to the kind of county level Democratic Party, and then a couple others, kind of like church groups and things like that, that had a social justice component to them. And they were all doing great work. And it was, there was probably about 60 people who were in attendance. But, it wasn't really like, it wasn't really naming the elephant in the room, which is that while all of these individual organizations were doing great work kind of for their specific thing, it was so obvious that they were not talking to each other, that they were not working with each other, that they weren't thinking in a kind of more, in a broader or bigger way of what change should really look like and what we need. So I like raised my hand and kind of said that. And it was sort of it felt a bit audacious, and I think it was kind of taken that way. But after I asked that question, I had like, I don't know, five or six folks come up to me and like, thank you so much for asking that. I was thinking the same thing, not sure what I'm supposed to do here. And I just happened to meet an organizer of a burgeoning grassroots group in the town that I live in. And she was like, we want you to come and be one of our kind of key, like, organizers and points of contact for some of the pillars that we're doing. So that's how I got sort of involved. And it was literally just a random decision on a Sunday to like go and hand out these flyers that led me to meeting these people. And it just snowballed. I started going to the grassroots meetings. I started just randomly getting introduced to folks and having coffee with complete strangers. I started going to city council meetings. And started protesting regularly. There's been a social justice protest in this little tiny town that I live in since the kind of peak of the BLM movement that they've carried forward. And I just started joining it. And one of the things that I've realized is that, similarly to when I started sharing my story about surviving domestic violence and talking about it in from my experience and being and also from sharing being an ovarian cancer survivor, that just the mere fact that I am willing to kind of put that out there makes other people feel less alone, makes other people feel more connected, and gives other people a little bit more like courage to go and tell their own story. And I saw that same exact pattern in the early days and have continued to see it in the activism work that I've been doing in my community, where as soon as I started showing up on the at the weekly protests, more people started showing up. When we had some of our early grassroots meetings with, all of the larger meetings with 500-ish people, just the fact that we were there and we were talking to each other and that we weren't afraid to use words like resistance, or weren't afraid to call MAGA and regressives, and really speak to that in a way that was like direct and straightforward, gave people more confidence to do the same. So a couple of the things that we've done through our grassroots organization is we've really focused on kind of three main areas. One is mutual aid and building up an alternative system to mass consumerism within our community. Two is a true sort of boots on the ground resistance arm, where we are, it is both a digital resistance of protecting people who are being targeted and doxxed in some of our local MAGA Facebook groups, as well as protests and creating kind of hosting like national events like No Kings. And then third is really focusing on local politics and helping people get involved in our local government to make change right here at home.
Which kind of ties into my next point is elections.
Yeah.
So, no matter how big or how small the election is, every election matters.
Yes.
And electing people who represent the people versus these corporations versus selling out people like my mom, who is a cancer patient and will be a cancer survivor. And I know, Kelsey, you relate to this very, very heavily. But obviously, her healthcare matters, your healthcare matters, my healthcare matters, and everybody's healthcare matters. And that's something that's really big, here in Kansas that we're talking about is healthcare access. Because Kansas does not have Medicaid expansion, but luckily, my mom's is through the state of Missouri, which does have Medicaid expansion. And as of right now, it has not been touched and it's not going to be touched, but that can change at literally the drop of a pencil. So, whenever we think about elections, and you mentioned about consumerism just a second ago, and it kind of piqued my interest because we're going into the holiday season,
Yeah.
which Starbucks has been doing a lot of union busting. They've been doing a lot of, personally, fuck Starbucks, first of all. But there's a lot of consumerism in that because it goes into the fact of like, do I really need that peppermint mocha, or can I go to my locally owned, women-owned, minority-owned small business and support them, right?
Yeah.
So, with that being said, I know that that's not the case in every single community, but it's also as simple as donating to an organization that could use that funds to help people get back on their feet. Right. And there's so many organizations like that, even like local or like locally and also nationally, and just, donate it to a pet shelter or donate it to your local Oh gosh, there's so many things to kind of like donate that money to, because if you're going to spend $13, $14 on this coffee at Starbucks, that $15 can help feed a child, or it can help feed a shelter pet, or it can help, an elderly person. Oh God, there's so many things. So whenever you mentioned about consumerism, it kind of piqued my interest. But I would love for you to kind of pivot a little bit and talk about like what's upcoming, in your area, and like if anybody who's listening, I don't know if there's anybody in your area or in Michigan. I can't see that, but it's also encouraging to kind of see what's happening there, because people that are listening, you can get involved in your local community too and be the voice and be the change and bring
Yeah.
people together. Even if it's just one person can make that change. It has to start somewhere. And
Yeah.
then those are rippling effects that continue throughout the communities. And these are positive rippling effects outside of like gun violence and outside of domestic violence, which obviously continues to run rampant through rampant through our communities. But yeah, kind of pivot and talk about some election stuff that's kind of happening, and what are you seeing in that regard?
Yeah, I think before I jump into the elections, I do think the kind of the building of mutual aid and helping folks embrace sort of a new definition of community is probably some of the most important and hardest work that we've been doing. So, personally, this has been part of my journey as well. So one of the ways that I survived, not thrived, but survived cancer and domestic violence is I just threw myself into my job. I am and was a kind of serial startupper. I was always kind of looking for the next thing and wanted to climb and wanted to overachieve and ended up just constantly being this in the cycle of being like in very toxic relationships with bosses and also just burnt out because all I was doing was working and that was so much of my identity. And one of the things that I've unlearned in the last year or so is that I don't want my job to be the most interesting thing about me. I have learned that I have got so much more to offer. And I lost my job at the end of last year and was devastated by it, but it actually ended up being the best thing that could have happened for me. It was the first time in since the time I was 15 that I had more than 2 weeks between either work or school. And I know I am not unique in that experience. It was the first time where I had months to just like breathe and relax and like figure out what the fuck I really wanted to be doing with my life. And again, like I feel like the universe kind of aligned because I had this epiphany of like I am working to make money. But I am not working to like, I don't want my work to be my entire life. I want to be able to have energy and capacity for more than that. And the grassroots activism gave me the more. So, a lot of the work that I've been really focused on in like, No Kings have been great kind of milestones over the last like 6 months. We had a No Kings rally in June that I organized and spoke at. We had about 1,000 people show up for that one, or maybe like 800, 900 people, I should say. And then we hosted another one in October where we had between 1,200 and 1,500 people show up. And a lot of what, I think what that does, and a lot of the messaging that I've had to that audience is, hey, showing up for a protest is fantastic, but you have to be doing more than that. We do not need like big grand heroes in the resistance, right? We need millions of acts of solidarity every single day. And it's really hard for white people to want to be able to do that. And part of it is that it's fucking inconvenient. Like, community is like inconvenient. It means you have to show up for city council at 7 p.m. on a Monday after working. It means that you, in order to embrace kind of a mutual aid lifestyle and approach, it means that you have to be okay with, going to the airport 30 minutes early so you can carpool with somebody, or that you are willing to ask for help when you need it and offer help for free. And that's really, really hard for people. As an example, there was a teacher who put out a request in a Facebook group that she needed like cushions resewn for her classroom. And I reached out to her and said, "Hey, I'll just make your cushions for you." And she like could not wrap her head around the fact that someone would just do that, to the point where she was like forcing me to like take money. And it's, I get it. It's hard to unlearn, that like that consumerist drive, especially if you're in the Midwest, because there's so much shame that comes with either not working, offering your services for free, or asking for help. And so helping people kind of get more comfortable with asking for and accepting and offering help, has been really hard, but we've seen some really great things in the last just couple of weeks that I feel like are kind of showing that it is possible in communities like mine to sort of help people kind of rethink this. So with the SNAP benefits being cut, that has a major impact where we live. There's one food pantry that services our part of the county that we're in. I actually volunteer there on Wednesdays. And we put a call out to the community, like, hey, they're going to have Faith in Action is going to have a much higher demand with SNAP benefits being cut. So they need donations. And I worked with the director there to find a way to be able to offer people like food gift cards to local grocery stores as well. And we put the call out, but at the same time, there were other people who were reaching out to the like owners of tiny libraries across town and working with them to turn them into tiny food banks. So there was this kind of multi-touch motion of regular people in the community just showing up to help, that I hadn't really seen before. And similarly, when it, and that gave me a lot of hope, right? And then similarly with local elections, so 2026 elections feels like a very long time away. I don't know what's going to happen with voter access and voter rights at the national level. But we in Chelsea had an off-year city council mayoral election. There were three city council seats up, and then the mayoral seat up. And I think there's about like 5,000-ish registered voters in Chelsea. And we, myself and a few other people, supported and worked with some of the progressive candidates that were running for these seats. They're nonpartisan positions, but of course, there's always going to be politics that play a part in it. There were two kind of opposing candidates, one for the city council and one for the mayoral race, and it got really nasty. They had some of the loudest kind of MAGA voices behind them. They were blatantly spreading lies, trying to get like it got really, really ugly and really messy. But we had the highest voter turnout, period, for the last like 20 years since Chelsea's been a city, for this off year local election. 2,700 something people turned up to vote, and the progressive candidates won by like a landslide. And that story, which I feel like, again, we can't be the only ones. Our town can't be the only one that's seen this, but that story combined with kind of these high profile off year elections with Mamdani and Spemberger really gave me hope that people don't just want aren't just voting against Trump, but they want candidates that are going to bring real change and real progress that counteracts what, again, like the big capital D Democratic Party has become.
And I say this as a PSA member. I absolutely agree. Yeah, because there's a lot that I agree with. There's a lot that I don't agree with. And that's kind of like what encompasses like my entire ideology. But my ideology is very simple. Whenever it comes down to protecting basic human rights and understanding like how incredibly crucial that is, at the end of the day, doesn't matter if I'm left, right, or blue, red, whatever. At the end of the day, it just matters that I'm a decent human being and I fight for all people. And my mom is my reason for why I created the movement, or part of the reason why I created the movement, is to give a voice to those that are like her that had their voices silenced. And how do we, as a community, recognize that now is the time to rise up? So Rise Above Justice movement is not just a movement, it's a mission to incorporate the voices that do not reach the international or even like national or even like local headlines, because mainstream media is not going to save us. I've said this numerous times on this podcast, and I'm going to say it again. I mean, look what's happening with the New York Times. I don't know if you saw this, Kelsey, but there was three opinion pieces that were
You
published
know I
that were
did.
I know you have something to say about this, so that's going to be my actual next question, is whenever you see headlines that talk about have women ruined the workplace? Oh my God. And then one of the other ones is, what is toxic femininity? And I'm like, you mean masculinity? Because I understand that women can be catty and like non-binary people and trans people can be catty, but New York Times, what the fuck are you doing?
Yeah, it's so I have a very dear friend who I've been friends with since I was 11. Her name is Annie. She lives in New York, and she's super smart, and she is like just an been a really good sounding board for me kind of throughout this year. Besides just being a very dear friend, she's also very active, and she's a big believer in mutual aid, and she is very a little bit of a nihilist in the best, most positive way. And so she and I don't always agree on things. She's a little bit more extreme than I am. But we've really been able to kind of play off of each other and be a sounding board as I'm kind of working through how to get this very white, Midwest community to create some sustainable real change while she is kind of in the thick of it in Brooklyn in New York, right? So they're two very different worlds, very different real day-to-day impact, very different experiences with this regime, right? Because you can't hide what's going on in New York. But here in Chelsea, we're still a little bit of insulated from it, right? And part of what she and I talk about a lot is like questioning absolutely every single article that exists out there. And the question is, and I got this from her, is like, who benefits from me reading this? And who benefits from make me feeling this way about it? And think one of the hardest things about fighting the Trump regime today is he controls media, right? He controls both, or has friends that, that are running. He's got loyalists at all of these kind of national newspapers and media agencies, and then all of his friends control social media. So he's basically in control of both the production and the distribution of practically every way anybody can get any information. So helping people find out what's true is so hard. So some of the things that we've done, one of the first things that we did with Grassroots is we actually built a website called a community hub that linked to, like an events calendar for like protests and different progressive events and things like that, but also has a resources section where people in our grassroots org do a bunch of research and basically put together like info sheets and talking points and shareable social media pieces around kind of key legislation or topics, because it's just so fucking hard to find out what's true. So when I read these headlines of that New York Times about the toxic femininity and have women ruin the workplace, A, just makes me mad. But B, I have that question in the back of my head, right? Of like, who is benefiting from this headline being out there? And like, the patriarchy fucking benefits from it, right? Because not only does it make me question my role and in the workplace, but it makes other people kind of like, why is this woman being, kind of like creates this subversive like question in people's heads about a woman in a boardroom or a woman on a leadership team of like, maybe she is toxic. And with women in particular, there's been several studies about this that as a woman, its title goes up, her likability goes down, and people are more apt to assume a negative image of her just by suggestion than a man. So a piece like that that's titled like that, it's a suggestion that a woman doesn't belong in the workplace, doesn't belong in leadership, and that by being there, they're toxic, they're doing something wrong, they're nefarious, they're ruining things. Which 1000% reinforces all of the other kind of rollbacks that this administration is trying to do for women and for just people who aren't rich white men, to be frank.
You know, I was getting ready to take a shower today, and I happened to look over at my phone, and I wanted to pick it up, but I didn't. And I continued the shower, and then I'm like, okay, wait, I just gotta check Instagram because I that's where I get like majority of my information from, because we're following some like really big accounts that, like do some like new stuff, and a lot of content creators. We collaborate with a lot of content creators, and we have 234,000 followers now, but even more like on Threads, and then like combined, it's close to like 300,000 followers. But I got a notification, and I saw that Octavia Spencer followed us on Instagram today. Now, whenever I think about gender equity and pay equity, I think about Octavia Spencer because she helped fight like hell for people like Jessica Chastain. to fight for pay, to negotiate and fight for fair pay. And, she took on a producer role to create opportunities she and others might not have otherwise gotten. And she was a big champion in the Me Too movement and the Time's Up, because there is a reference at the Sundance Film Festival in 2018. Spencer emphasized that the Me Too and Time's Up movements should focus on empowering all abuse survivors, and not devolve into women versus men. She stressed the importance of listening to voices that have been silenced and believing those who come forward, noting there is power in numbers. And she's just
Yeah.
been a really big role model in changing the game for women, queer people. And
100%.
I know her because of some of the movies that she's been in. I know her because of her advocacy work. But to see her follow the movement that I created, that's not backed by billionaires, not backed by a corporation, and we're not associated with any party, because to be quite frank, they all suck because we live in a two-party system.
Right.
To be frank, I understand that there's lesser of evils. I understand that entirely. I do. I understand that entirely. However, we got to recognize what we have. And what I would love to see is just people unite and understand that people need to be more like Octavia Spencer and less like Pete Hegseth. So with
Yeah,
that
well,
being
I think that's true. I think that's true. And again, kind of going back to my journey here, right? Like maybe 3 or 4 years ago, I decided for the first time, kind of publicly, I was going to talk about my experience with sexual assault and with domestic violence. And I wrote a Medium article, about being a survivor and shared it on LinkedIn for International Women's Day. And I was so terrified because a lot of like close friends, a lot of my family don't really know how bad it was for me. And I really put myself out there to talk about it. And part of the reason why I did it is that again, there is, I think every survivor's story is unique, but there are common threads of shame, of pain, of fear, and of just like regret that are really complicated. And, personally, I do not forgive my abuser, but I also don't want retribution. I also had to learn how to forgive myself because I think one of the things that doesn't get talked about is that as a survivor, you feel shame and guilt for both surviving when other people haven't. You also feel like there's a watermark for what abuse really is, and were you abused enough to call yourself a victim or a survivor? And you, I don't want to put like my experience on others, but I really felt I had to come to terms with feeling complicit with my own abuse in some ways too, right? I know that it was not of my making. It was not my fault. It was not me. The blame wasn't on me, but there were choices that I made, right? And kind of coming to terms with this happened to me. This will always be part of me. And how do I move on beyond that, right? Is a really powerful story that doesn't get told. So I shared this article. And I got hundreds of messages from women that I worked with, past coworkers, friends, family members of just, oh my gosh, thank you for voicing what I've felt. I've experienced this too. I didn't know this happened to you. I would have never imagined that you were a victim. And it was really powerful because holy shit, all these women have gone through something like this, right? Like there's a stat of like 1 in 3 women will be sexually assaulted in her lifetime, which means if you have a mother, a sister, and a wife, one of them has been assaulted. It's probably more. And I think unless we have more voices being willing to share that experience, we sort of lose the control of the narrative. And I think that's kind of what we're kind of battling with the Epstein files, to be honest, is that besides this massive conspiracy and cover up that is just vile, it is really a fight for survivors to be able to control a narrative and to be able to show just how common this type of abuse is in our world and that it's hidden and not okay. So I think that it's both like sharing the story and then also being willing to get a little bit dirty with the MAGA crowd and call them out on their nonsense. So every small town in this country probably has a two different versions of a community Facebook group, the one that's monitored and the one that's not. And in Chelsea, we have one that is not. And it is just full of really horrible right-wing nonsense. There's probably five or six just very noisy trolls there that just share lies every single day, mean, horrible lies, both nationally, at the local level, calling, our members of our school board groomers because they're gay and have children and want, a picture book with two dads in it at school. And like just nonsense. And what we've started to do is just like engage with that and say, no, this is not true. This is, like with No Kings as an example, they completely tried to say that the No Kings protest that we held in Chelsea was funded by Soros. All the protesters were paid, and that we just farmed out the retirement communities and bused them there to so we would have people. And I was a fucking organizer of No Kings. It was definitely not paid since I, myself and other volunteers put money in to make it happen. And also, like, we just put it out there. People just showed up. So I had firsthand experience with it. I wrote a little kind of recap and shared photos and videos of the event and posted it to this alternate Facebook group in Chelsea and like broke the group for 10 days. It got thousands of likes, all these comments, and a lot of it was trolls, but there was some real discourse that was happening there. And it's really encouraged other people to just start jumping into these conversations and calling them out on their own bullshit. And it's important to do. And I know that there's kind of a hesitancy because you don't want to like amplify and da 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 da. It's already fucking amplified. We need more people willing to be like, no, this is a lie. No, this is hate speech. Hey, this feels really racist. Hey, that's not what grooming means. And go to the space where that's happening.
And it's all a part of showing the fuck up and showing the fuck out, and that's what it comes down to. So you bring that spirit to the community organizing, and I think that's the thing that I love the most about watching just everything that you're doing. I think it's so incredibly inspiring. So to anybody out there who would like to follow Kelsey, where can they find you at on social media, and how can they amplify your work that you have going on?
I am not super active on social, but I do. Instagram is probably the best place to find me. I'm Kelsey doing her best on Instagram. I'm also Kelsey doing her best on Blue Sky, but Blue Sky has gotten a little weird, so I haven't been on there as much. But find me there. I post a lot of artwork and try to amplify truth as much as I can through the platform that I have. And I think I would just encourage everybody, I think just with two things. One, don't wait for someone else to give you permission to share your story and to be a voice for what you think is right in this world. Just start using your voice. You'll be surprised by how it's received. And two, get off of social media as much as you can. Like, it's powerful and it's got a place, but go out and meet people. Go out and interact. Go introduce yourself to your neighbors. Go ask someone for coffee. Go talk to a cashier. Start really engaging and showing up in the community that you live in. Fascism wins when we feel isolated. And social media, as great as it is in some ways, is also a mechanism for isolation and an echo chamber. So find a way to get out and be with people.
Absolutely. Kelsey, thank you so much for coming on the podcast today. And you heard it, folks. Get out there and be the change. Kelsey, thank you so much for coming on the podcast today. Take care of yourself, my friend, okay?
Thank you, Zachary.
Thank you.